This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive. This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive. Welcome to the next 10 hours of the WBAI 50th birthday anniversary birthday celebration kickoff and pregame. Such a contentious station that people are even arguing over whether this 50th birthday is really an anniversary. In these 2 hours, we will address the contribution of Louis Schweitzer and the prehistory of WBAI as a Pacifica station, WBAI's role in changing the sound of New York and the radio landscape through its artistic, political, and technical innovations, early news coverage, comedy, and drama. And we will have lots of old friends and guests and radio voices that you have not heard for a very long time, including, and some you've heard very recently, maybe last night, Marshall Efron, Paul Krasner, Jim Freund, Margot Adler, Paul Fisher, Carol Ratner, Robert Knight, David Rapkin, and Peter Zanger. I'm Janet Coleman, and you are?
David Dozer.
The displaced playwright. I want to go back a little ways to Louis Schweitzer. At our parent network, Pacifica's 50th anniversary several years ago, most of the focus was on the ideas and ideology of Lou Hill, the conscientious objector who created listener-sponsored radio at KPFA in Berkeley, California. Today, we're going to invoke a little bit the other Louis Schweitzer, the benefactor of WBAI, the millionaire who supposedly, maybe an apocryphal story, but supposedly wanted to be able to see the tower, the tower at the Empire State Building from his hotel room
at the Hotel Pierre,
his apartment hotel. He inherited a paper mill in France, a family paper mill that produced, I believe, cigarette papers and the fine paper for that surrounded tampons. And he also bought a theater for his wife, Lucille Lortel. Now that theater is called the Lucille Lortel Theater. At the time, it was called the Theater de Lise. He used his radio station, the radio station he bought, to do theater reviews over there at the Theater de Lise so that his WBAI listeners would be apprised of his wife's theater doings. And, of course, one of the great plays that she produced there, she did a lot of experimental off-Broadway and sort of forged a link between WBAI and off-Broadway forever, was the Three Penny Opera, where a young actor named Bob Fass was working in the company. But Lou Schweitzer had some idea of radio that a character that had a sort of special New York flavor, different from that of the station in Berkeley. And it was intentional, I think, that more than luck, that brought the kind of New York WBAI, the difference in sound to this station from the ones in the our other sister stations. Lou Hill did not want to have a radio station with commercials. And during a newspaper strike, he was bombarded with solicitations from people who couldn't advertise in the newspapers. The station began making a ton of money as they aired these commercials. Lou Hill said, he said, I realized right then, when we were the most successful commercially, that that was not what we wanted at all. He said, I saw that if the station ever succeeded, it would be a failure. Well, we live with that ambivalent desire to this day. But we want to play a little bit of the voice of Lou Schweitzer purported. It might be either Lou Schweitzer or Lou Schweitzer, the cab driver he hired to bus him and his wife Lucille around throughout the city. He bought the taxi medallion, and he had the radio on the taxi cab forever tuned to WBAI. This is the voice of one of those Louis Schweitzers.
One of the things lacking in radio today is humor. WBAI is as guilty as any other station in this respect. The humorists seem to have all gone uptown to television. Where are those wonderful programs of yesteryear?
People have been writing in for something educational. Could you suggest something educational?
Well, just let them listen to this program once. That'll teach them a lesson.
You know, you're getting better, Ben. Huh? You're getting bitter, Ben. But I could suggest something pretty educational. A quiz program as done by a certain Dr. I. somebody. And it goes something like this. Would you introduce it, Ben?
Ladies and gentlemen, Czar's Bars, the candy of czars everywhere, brings you the most popular quiz program on the air. Yes, whether you're a czar or just a peasant, you'll love Czar's Bars. Czar's Bars make your teeth stronger. They're the favorites of Russian beavers. Remember, Czar's Bars, the only candy bar that contains lumber. Now, here's our genial quiz master, Dr. I.J., the mental fox.
I have a young man, Doctor.
I'm terribly sorry, but I'm afraid we don't have...
Wait a minute, Doc. I come here week after week. You're never calling me. What's the matter? I'm too little.
I'm sorry, but why don't you take this box of Czar's Bars...
I can't eat them, Doc. They make me break out.
Well,
I... come on, Doc. Ask me something. For one silver dollar... A measly silver dollar. Come on, what do you say? Huh? What do you say? Come on. Don't be a piker.
Very well. The yes and no category. I will give you 5 measly silver dollars for each correct answer. Yes or no. Here is the first one. Is the Amazon River?
But, Doc...
Yes or no?
Yes.
I'm sorry, it isn't. Here is your next question. Your next question, sir. Does a bicycle... Yes, it does. Now, your final question. Am I?
Yes.
No, I'm not, but a box...
Yes, you are, Doc. You're the biggest one I ever seen.
That's the kind of stuff I think we should have more of. Never use a preposition to end a sentence with. Did you recognize the voices of Henry Morgan and Arnold Stang? By the way, WBAI has asked me to announce that Henry Morgan will join this station not sometime in August, but actually August the 4th at 8 p.m. Another program which will soon be heard on 99.5 megacycles is a 15-minute daily roundup of news and programs heard on shortwave. A pickup will be made of as many foreign countries as possible, including the Iron Curtain countries. So if you suddenly hear Radio Moscow on WBAI, don't run to the telephone to report us. We have State Department approval for this program. Just to give you an idea of what it sounds like, we will now play for you this excerpt from the news and musical broadcast from Radio Moscow, made just 2 days ago.
We just want to add that if you have any more questions, John McDonald of Vancouver, B.C., please write to us, and we'll be glad to give you the answers. We follow now with some popular music. And it's music that composer Strassman wrote for the movies.
WBAI regularly undoubtedly have heard some of our BBC broadcasts. These are sent to us from England as soon as they are available. Sometimes there's a delay in receiving them, and so we keep one recording on hand for just such a possibility. Here it is now.
Good afternoon. This is Googie Morgan about to bring you the broadcast of today's encounter between the Blue Stockings of Punting on Thames and the White Jerseys of Jersey. Here in London at Tinkieboo Stadium, there's the usual heavy fog and the slight drizzle which make it so wonderful to be in England now that April's here. At first bat for the Blues shall be Alfred Twickenham Bart. You'll note that he still uses the designation Bart, though as a suspended barrister, he's actually Desbart. Particularly interesting play, that. Faversham at short, through to Eversham at second, who, whirling smartly, threw to Frothingham at first. They did it most carefully. Faversham to Eversham to Frothingham, leaving nothing to chance. Well, that was the final play of the afternoon, the better team having won, of course. We shall take leave of you here at Tinkieboo Stadium and return you to our main studios. There, after a while, you are to hear a talk given by Maud, Lady Fallow, entitled Swamp Fires I Have Known.
By the way, that, of course, was Henry Morgan and not BBC. Well, folks, I've got to get back to the cab now. The doorman at the Pier Hotel has just telephoned up to say that my car is blocking the doorway. See you again sometime.
The program you have just heard constitutes a little gentle nose-thumbing at ourselves and our profession, along with some things we sincerely felt have too long been departed from the airwaves or too rarely heard. It'll also serve as a little foretaste of some things to come on WBAI-FM, we hope.
Foretaste indeed. I guess that was the real Lou Schweitzer, I think, because he did mention the Hotel Pierre, and I don't guess that the taxi driver, Lou Schweitzer, was receiving calls from the doorman. When the money began pouring in, Lou Schweitzer thought it over a bit and decided to unload his beloved radio station on Lou Hill, who was running the listener-supported, non-commercial KPFA in Berkeley. And that transition is actually recalled by another great and famous humorist whom you're familiar with at WBAI and has pervaded the Pacifica radio stations in Los Angeles and also in Berkeley for years. And it's the, you know him from the Great American Dream Machine and Bible Stories You Can't Forget. He starred in Marshall Efron's Illustrated, Simplified, and Painless Sunday School and went on, of course, to become a voice actor and featured in so many animated works, including The Smurfs. Hello, Marshall.
Hi.
Well, now you seem to be the living person who has the gossip on what went on in the interlude between BAI as a Schweitzer-held station and BAI as a Pacifica station. What's the scoop?
This is not much of a story. It's like basically an overheard event. I want to say that KPFA and little tiny KPFB, there was a little, the way they worked it out, the signal from KPFA really got all over the Bay Area. It was a very powerful San Francisco Bay Area, very powerful antenna. However, it missed Berkeley, where it was located. So that's why they had to have KPFB. And there was a little station called KPFB, which broadcast exactly the same as the KPFA did. And the PF, KPFA and KPFB, that stood for Pacifica Foundation. I thought everyone would know that. But that wasn't...
You're a good speller.
Yeah. So anyway, I was on a weekend, I think it was a weekend, or maybe it was in the middle of the week. I'm not sure about that, or even what year it was. But my girlfriend and I went to the Fuji Inn, a very nice Japanese restaurant in Berkeley, to have dinner. And the table right behind us was full of Pacifica people, and they were celebrating because the three or four members at that table, there must have been seven or eight people then, those three or four were going to New York the next day. They were going to New York the next day to pick up the keys to the radio station WBAI. And they celebrated. They had a wonderful time. They laughed. They enjoyed themselves. And the thing about KPFA and B in Berkeley was that everybody listened. Everybody listened to that station. The station was, it was charismatic and magnetic and exciting. And people listened. They listened to almost everything that was on that air. So the people who were running the station, who were on the air personalities, were very well known to everybody in the community. So it was like sitting down and having a meal, and there at another table was people that I...
You recognized. You knew.
I recognized them. I didn't know them really. I had gone to KPFA to stuff envelopes and help mail out the folio on occasion as a volunteer, but that was about it.
And when did you make your first appearance on WBAI? And what was the, you know, the thread? What was the joy about? Was it that they were enlarging the network, or that they had a sister station, or that...
No.
Just they had a key.
I had a radio show on KPFK in Los Angeles called Club 86. We were doing alternate radio. We were doing weird things. Like, we took a long, long cable on a microphone, and I went out, and I treated the traffic on Coenga Boulevard as a sporting event. And I would talk about the speed of the cars that went by, the color of the cars. Our show was on alternate Fridays from midnight to 5 o'clock in the morning. And so I treated the late-night traffic.
Well, let's bring in now a cultural analyst here who may be able to link this this traffic on Coenga Boulevard to what was happening in New York. Paul Krasner, who, you know, is the editor and publisher of The Realist, the founder of Yippie, the defendant in the trial of the Chicago 7, briefly editor of Hustler, and is most recently editor of In Praise of Indecency, and also Who's to Say What's Obscene, Politics, Culture, and Comedy in America Today, published by City Lights Books. Paul has what was happening in this country that could make this humorous cross-country trip, audio trip, so potent in American culture?
Well, at the time, I was an underground abortion referral service. Abortion was illegal, and
through The Realist.
Excuse me?
Through The Realist.
Yeah, I had interviewed, he's dead now so I can mention his name, Dr. Robert Spencer in Ashland, Pennsylvania, who had people coming to him from all over the country. And once I interviewed him, I began to get calls from teenagers to women in their 40s who were pregnant and didn't want to be. And at the time, I had been invited to do a commentary on a jazz radio show. I forget the call letters, but the DJ was Les Davis. And it was going very nicely. You know, I could talk about controversial things, but one time I did a commentary about reproductive rights and talked about the cruelty and lack of privacy that was involved in the abortion laws. And So that was the last show I did there, but Bob Fast knew about it, invited me to talk about it on WBAI. And it was like an extended family there. He would invite me back regularly, and I could talk about anything I wanted into the wee hours of the morning, and we would answer calls. And then that spread. Steve Post began having me on his show often on weekends. And then Larry Josephson had me on often on Sunday mornings while he ate bagels. And then more recently, you've had me on your show with David. But so it really became a big part of my life. And And it continued. You know, when I moved from New York to San Francisco, I had a show. My radio guy was Larry Bensky, and I was on his show and then did interviews there. And then when I moved to Venice Beach, I was on Roy Tuchman, who was had
Roy
the midnight
of Hollywood.
Roy of Hollywood.
Roy
huh?
of Hollywood, right? And so I was on his show a lot. So it really was like an extended family across the country, not just in the New York metropolitan area. And when I got married to Gene Johnson in 1963, we would come to the station, and in the next year or two, there was a program called It's Your World and You Can Have It, and I was invited to do commentary on that, and my wife and I went to the station, and I sat next to a woman named Nancy Kane. And we never got to know each other, but my first marriage didn't work out because of my immaturity. But 4.5 decades later, living in Venice, I found myself living across the street from Nancy Kane, who is my current wife. So WBAI had a kind of integral part of my life, both as a cultural commentator and in my married life.
Who influenced who more? Paul Krasner influencing the Pacifica stations with your kind of intermingling of political activism and comedy activism. I mean, I don't know how we could describe that, but WBAI did create a kind of new boundary for comedy.
Paul and I had one thing in common that we did that was most exciting.
What was that? A famous
event that occurred when we pretended to be Columbia students.
Oh, that's right, during the Columbia University strike.
And one of us was Danny the Red, the other was Rudy Joyce, and Bridget Potter was Emma Goldman.
Right, this was on a Sunday night when Steve Post had asked me to take over for him. He had to go somewhere or he was ill. And so we pretended to be, and I announced in a nasal voice that I'm from Columbia, and the strike is going on, and things are happening here. We're taking over this station because the airwaves belong to the people.
People.
And so some listeners took it as a real thing, and it was Marshall and Bridget Potter who... were the other two students with me, supposedly.
We wrote a manifesto, which we read.
And so some of the listeners called the police, and the police came.
We were scrupulous about giving the call letters at
the
half hour and the hour. We did everything correctly. We played Judy Collins records.
And so I'm sorry, go ahead.
We read our manifesto.
And so some listeners called the cops. The cops came, and we told them, no, it was just a hoax. And so they left, and then I said on the air, oh, boy, the cops were just here, and we fooled them. we told them we were on the radio here, but, you know, we didn't tell them that the real WBAI people were locked in the closet. And
the
so
bathroom.
People called the cops, and the cops came again. So we were just professional brats about it. But I met Marshall first when I moved to San Francisco, and I was invited to be on a show Peter Bergman had from the Firesign Theater, and Marshall would pick me up at the airport and bring me to the to the station whenever I visited Berkeley, after I moved to L.A. during Contragate, and we were doing weekly commentaries on it, and we got calls from people. We made them give their code name. We had code names. Peter Bergman was Commandante Baldy, and I was Thunderheart. And this came because because the people involved, like who was that military guy who testified and got off on technicalities?
Callie?
Callie? No. He was
North.
Busy.
Oliver North.
And he had some code name, something like Steel Drum or something. And so we had everybody who called up, because it was interactive, to give their code name first. And people named themselves Slush Fund or Cassandra. And it was kind of fun about a very serious matter. Some people still call me Thunderheart.
What in terms of type of irreverence, what really was the difference? I was listening to an archival piece of Steve Post or Larry Josephson trying to explain what was the rough and tumble, the nasty nature of New York that was mirrored in WBAI in particular. Was it a more Pacifican atmosphere at A or K, where it was warm and balmy?
No, I never found that either. You know, it was, as Lenny Bruce used to say, when he would go from town to town, and it always seemed like the same audience was there. You know, people in every town, small towns, you know, you'd find a teacher who had a pet lamb in his living room. There, all of the odd people, in the best sense of the word, were in every city, and I didn't find any difference geographically.
And Marshall, no difference, huh?
None whatsoever. It was everybody was everybody. There was 2,000 people apparently. That was the underground, and
it was the underground.
That was it, and we all thought that we were 2,000 people. Maybe we were 200,000 or 2 million or 20 million.
I think radio must have had the effect of convincing us all that there were millions, huh?
It did. It did. When I first came to New York, and that was in 1967, every night I'd put on the radio and I'd just go across the dial. But I would always stop at BAI because it was the most interesting, it was the most real. This is about Bob's show, Bob Fest.
Right.
It was the most real, it was the most exciting, and the truth could be told. The truth was being told all the time. It was like the only place you can get the truth. Everything else was BS, and it continues to this day.
It was the broadcasting equivalent of the underground press, the weekly papers, anti-establishment, for drugs, sex, rock and roll.
Right.
And it was the counterculture at its heart was the spiritual revolution. As Lenny Bruce said, people were leaving the churches and going back to God.
What struck me is so interesting is that even Louis Schweitzer, this millionaire with the kind of hard-boiled New York accent, even he had some need to have a counterculture. Was this an evolution from the 50s, this breakthrough that happened here in 1960? Why was everybody so poised and ready?
There was an evolutionary jump in consciousness. Around the world, it was a huge wave, and in this country that exploded out of the blandness and repression of the Eisenhower Nixon years, and it just spread. It was an epidemic of idealism, and outspokenness, and it just spread because it was roiling in people anyway, and it was a station like WBAI that served as an outlet for that, where people could talk about legalized marijuana, where people
That sounds good too.
oh yeah, have it on fudge
legalized
brownies.
legalized marinara and fudge brownies. It's a new one.
Yes. We had the whole Italian government behind us on that one.
They knew how to lick the pot.
Yes, in every way, and so. It became an organizing tool, a community theater. In the movie Chicago 10 about the protests at the Democratic Convention and the conspiracy trial that followed, there were animated scenes of Bob Fass on the radio talking to Abby Hoffman in Chicago, giving a report.
Mm-hmm.
And so the station served as a vehicle to communicate the difference between what we experienced on the streets and how the mainstream media reported it.
And it was available.
Yeah.
And people could report that, you know, that it was, now it's the internet with people putting stuff on YouTube or on their blogs or on their Twitter account. But then it was people calling in from the Yippin at Grand Central Station, reporting what happened as it was happening. It was really very exciting and informative. If there was going to be a demonstration or a love-in, people would call in, and Fass, who was sort of like the mayor of nightly New York,
right.
would have these people reporting in. It was like everybody was an investigative reporter because they were on the scene.
Well, speaking of investigative reporters, we have now, the room is beginning to fill up with them, and I'd like to, let me remind you all that this is WBAI, and we are launching here our 50th anniversary or birthday year. WBAI went on the air as a Pacifica station 50 years ago, and this will be a very wonderful year of recalling all of the moments, all of the firsts, all of the frustrations, all of the breakthroughs that were made here on WBAI and throughout the Pacifica network during that year, during these years, the 50 years. By the way, we have a, and also speaking of counterculture, a note from Jimmy Forat. Jim Forat, was he a Yippie?
Oh, sure. He was one of the unheralded Yippie organizers.
He was magnificent. He was one of the ones that threw money into Wall Street.
He certainly did. He was right there on the balcony. He should do it again. It would really be a very good encore.
That was Jim's idea, and then Abby and the others executed his idea.
Dumping money on the floor of the stock exchange, actual cash dollars. He says here, memory is a reality test of history. Thanks for remembering. Love and kisses, or kisses and hugs, from Jimmy Forat, Jim Forat. We have a email set up here for you listeners who have memories and who have congratulation notices for us. birthday@wbai.org, and we'll try to retrieve some of these messages and read them on the air. But let me introduce some of the people who are here in the studio. First off, I suppose the youngest and longest lasting WBAI person arrived at WBAI at 13 years old, memory being a form of history. You are the class historian here, Jim Freund. And let me also say that in the studio is also Margot Adler, who you know now from NPR, National Public Radio, and from her scholarship as a Wiccan and her books. But she was very much a part of WBAI's news team and culture and outreach and everything. Chris Wendt just said that you put him on the air, so.
Which I didn't even remember.
Remember, everybody's memory is going to be unfolding interestingly. Carol Ratner, who was part of the news department, I don't know the years. You want to count them?
Well, I don't think I was technically part of the news department. But,
what was your official role?
Producer.
Producer.
Elektra Rewired.
The early feminist programs on WBAI. And Paul Fisher, who was WBAI news director from?
1968 to 1973. And before we go on, I'd like to...
My first boss. Was he really? He was Margot Adler's first boss.
Have you forgiven me yet? I want to thank the TSA people you have downstairs. They've assured me I'll get my underwear back on the way out.
And host, by the way, Paul Fisher, of What's the Frequency, Kenneth, which you can hear Wednesday at 2 o'clock, a new form of broadcasting called the Newsical that Paul has invented.
By the way, I didn't know Margo was going to be here, so I want to make this official. Some people say that my show belongs on NPR, which... And now I want Margot to attest to the fact that my show could never be on an NPR station.
What do you say, Margot?
I really don't know yet. I haven't listened enough, to be honest. But I'm going to guess yes.
In a proper universe.
But because the fact is the stuff we did on BAI could never air on NPR today. It's really sad. And I miss it a lot.
What, that sense of
boundaries? I mean, when Okay, I started out at Pacific at KPFA in 68 in like January, and that's a whole other story. But then I came to BAI, and I started out in news and did news, did the 11 o'clock news, 11 p.m. news, which was before the war summary and so forth. And then later was a producer. But then later started doing live radio, and it was live freeform radio that really was an incredibly unique thing that this station did better than any other station in the world, in history, I think.
And to a large extent invented it.
Invented it. Yeah. And the kinds of things that could be done, the kind of experimentation, allowing listeners to create a community, to create a show for you, actually, to truly create a deep community, a philosophical community on the airways, to explore every kind of wild issue from, you know, cloning to, you know, to feminist issues, to parapsychology, to everything, to politics and so forth, and do it in a way that was really deep and profound and yet free-flowing. There's never been anything like it. And I have to tell you that I look at the letters that I received when I did live radio, and maybe there were only 50,000 people listening at 5 in the morning, but the letters were 10-page, single-space, deep, deep encounters.
Some were actually from the audience.
And you would read these out loud, and then you'd get, the phones would open up, and the conversation would go elsewhere, and then you'd get 10 more of these kind of letters. And you could, and I guess what I would say is you could go on NPR and do a news story, and obviously you can do some things that have huge community response. But very often you'll do a story you sweat it on, and the only letter you get is that you pronounced Beijing wrong. You know? So what I'm saying is that the encounter with people, with community, that happened at this radio station was unbelievable, unbelievable. And it's something that I hope happens again.
Well, let me ask Jim Freund, as a 13-year-old, what nourishment were you getting from this? Besides the fact that Margot Adler eventually left you with the program she created, Hour of the Wolf, which is still running now.
She abandoned the show. I'm holding the space open. It's the very first thon, which is how I can date that I started May 1st, 1967. It was our first prolonged marathon.
You were here before we were. Poison Arts.
Before Poison Arts. But as, you know, as a, well,
no,
I wanted.
No, we were here on April 1st. Sorry, April
1st. Oh, okay. David, so, yeah, that's right. So predated me by a month.
Memory is history.
So there goes my seniority.
Bad memory is bad history.
And the, and to get rid of me, because God knows what I was like and underfoot. Well, Kathy Dobkin knows. Everybody had to get rid of me, right? So I was the bouncer. They put me downstairs in this brownstone at 39th Street because I was such an obnoxious little person. And the very first person who comes in is Frank Millspaugh, who's the stage manager. And he says, there's somebody out there behind us. Don't let him in. That was Steve Post. Now, it was Post that I doted on to listen to, which, of course, made me suspicious to him immediately.
You were too big a fan, huh?
Oh, right. Yeah. Fanboy, yeah. My 13-year-old fanboy, it's exactly. But at that same time, I was also, what I was getting, the nourishment I was getting was, as a listener, was listening to things like the radio, PYP, Programs for Young People, and the stuff that David Rapkin and Charlie Potter and something called Poisoned Arts, and all of that stuff was just so amazing and so compelling. So I started eventually hanging around and volunteering for the drama and literature department, Baird Searles, who ran it with people like Samuel R. Delaney. I haven't mentioned your name in seconds. Peter Zanger walked in, and James Ursay. And it was this sound, this thing that was just so amazing. Then eventually, to try to make long story short, but we're going to do this on other days, Margot Adler turned us into a 24-hour radio station. Carol Ratner broke the gender barrier with freeform radio, and Margot followed shortly after, but with the first regular and daily show. And that turned us into a 24-hour station. Then she went away to a science fiction writer's workshop.
Right. Make that distinction. Becoming a 24-hour station made a big difference. And having a woman on the air,
Fast
to...
Fast would turn the radio station off.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't clear exactly when, you know. Sometimes
somewhere
it would be 4,
three.
And sometimes it would be 4:30. And then Josephson would turn the station on. With his show in the morning at 7 o'clock. So there was this time where nothing was happening. And so, you know, and so what happened with me was I was involved in news and I decided that for complicated reasons that I really hated news. It's a whole other story. And I decided I wanted to do a show, but I didn't have the guts to just, because I'd never done a live radio show, I didn't have the guts to say, you know, hire me, I will do this, I will do that. I really felt actually pretty insecure at the time. And I said to them, well, you're not using this time. You know, there's this space. There's this empty space between 4-ish and 5 or whatever. Let Fast go to 5 and I'll take from 5 to 7 and we'll, you know, no one's using it. Let me do it. And you can even fire me. I'll go on unemployment, which I was, you know, and if it works, you can hire me back. Oh, I was so insecure, you know. I mean, never was I saying, oh, I'm, you know. So I did it, and that's an hour of the Wolf worked, and they hired me back, and we became a 24-hour radio station.
And that is what we still are. Let's take a little break here and listen. Peter Beauchamp assembled a compilation of early voices of WBAI. Let's hear a few of them because we'll pick up on some of the atmospherics that you've been describing.
How did you like that? I think it's great. One of the things lacking in radio today is humor. WBAI is as guilty as any other station in this respect. The humorists seem to have all gone uptown to television. Where are those wonderful programs of yesteryear?
Well, I don't know. You've done some very strange things on the radio, and I don't...
I apologize. I don't want to
judge you solely by the past.
Yes, that's true. Well, I was not aware of these things which you just brought to my attention, and I'll certainly be more careful in the future to try and protect my interests and the interests of America and democracy.
Our thanks to the Marine Corps Band for that stirring interlude. This is listener-sponsored radio in New York, WBAI 99.5 FM.
BAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello?
Hi.
I'd like to make a statement. Let's turn on the radio here. And I'd like to say I think that it's an outrage that these pathetically sick and unnatural creatures have all this constant, tremendous publicity over the communist-controlled mass media and to pollute the civilization of the United States and all the minds of the people. It's almost constant publicity over the radio.
About to go on the air, reaching out to our secret listeners, secretly bringing them a warning over the secret air into their secret ears.
Where am I?
You're on the radio. You're on the radio. What an opportunity to be valuable to the people who should mean a lot to you. I'm talking about all your secret friends over the airwaves. You're on the radio too.
And this is the kickoff, beginning, the pregame to the WBAI year of 50 years of broadcasting, the 50th anniversary or birthday. Today's the birthday. And Paul Krasner, you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Yay, hooray. And Marshall Efron, you still with us? He dumped us, Marshall. He was through with us. He'll be back. I want to say I'm Janet Coleman. You are...
David Dozer.
The displaced playwright, and we are now joined by Paul Fisher.
Can I be the misplaced modifier?
Welcome to it. Oh, there are scads of people walking in now. The misplaced modifier, Paul Fisher, host of What's the Frequency, Kenneth, and news director of WBAI from 68 till he became news director of KPFA. Carol Ratner, producer of Electra Unwired, was it called?
Rewired. Wireless.
Don't you listen to the radio?
I don't. And Margot Adler, the creator of Hour of the Wolf, Jim Freund is beneficiary and current host, Hour of the Wolf, where David Rapkin has just walked in, our prize-winning sound engineer, Robbie Osman, Peter Zanger, James Ursay. Everybody will have to try to get a word in edgewise here. Robbie Barish, sorry.
And if I may interject.
Yes, please do.
Perhaps a little-known fact today. I was the first female announcer hired at WBAI.
Bravo. Okay.
Right. Thanks to Steve Post.
Ooh, did he?
Steve? That?
Under severe pressure from Robin Morgan and a group of
and
very...
And Annette Renone.
Well, maybe not.
And a group of
that?
Very militant feminists.
What year was that?
That was 1969.
Let's talk a little bit about the newsroom in 1968. And Paul's forays into really, really dangerous work, dangerous investigative reporting. Do you want to even talk about your memory of being so young and having an assignment to go to Attica?
Yes, I know what you're referring to. The prisoner rebellion at Attica had gone on for a while. And we decided one day after the news I would get on a plane and go up to Attica. So I believe I flew to the closest place to Attica, which was Buffalo, got off the plane, and I went over to the car rental place. I forget whether it was Avis or Hertz. And I hadn't dealt with car rentals before, and I was under 25, and they wouldn't rent me the car. So I called Master Control, and the next thing I know, the teletype goes off at the car rental place, and it just says, "Give him the car." And I wound up driving from Buffalo to Attica in a Chrysler Imperial with my mutton chops, my ponytail, and my walrus mustache. Anyway, I found out later what happened was that they went down to Neil Conan and asked him, what should we do? Paul's at the airport. They won't rent him the car. He's not 25. So at the next station break, Neil went on the air, did the station break, and said, by the way, we have, Paul Fisher on the way to Attica. Unfortunately, he can't get a car because he's under 25. And he mentioned what car rental company it was. And apparently they were besieged by calls from listeners. And so
really?
Give him the car.
So that you had an almost standing army behind you as you pursued your news
right.
story.
Right. And, technically they were right. They don't rent cars to people under 25, but I didn't know that because I had never rented a car before.
I heard a tape of you explaining to another broadcaster why you would never go into network broadcasting, although you changed your mind at some point and stayed with Dan Rather for 25 years as his writer. But at the time, what was it that you were able to do at BAI News that couldn't have been done in any other newsroom and probably still can't be?
I don't really want to get that serious, but now that you've asked the question, what Pacifica had was time but no money. What a place like CBS News or the Network News has, at least back then, was they had money but no time. So you had all this money being spent to do maybe 30 pieces a day, but only 5 or 6 would get on the evening news. They had unlimited resources, and basically the best stuff floated to the top. What we had was the time and the inclination and no money. I think it was more important to have the time to actually go out and report things. And I think basically There were only two innovations that I brought to BAI News. All of the basics were already there. The Agence France-Presse was already there. We had
That was a holdover from the Lou Schweitzer days or from days just preceding you?
Just preceding me. The previous Agence news director, Paul Schaefer, instituted AFP. He read a lot of out-of-town newspapers, and there was a tip line for people to call. The two things I think I did was the technology we had changed. You know, we didn't have to carry around 20-pound tape recorders reel-to-reel with batteries that only lasted 15 minutes. When the Sony TC-110 cassette machine came out, it was a couple of pounds. You could sling it over your shoulder and go anywhere, and the battery wouldn't die. You know, I could do things like one-time Vietnam Veterans Against the War called me up and said, listen, we're going to take over the Statue of Liberty. And I said, yeah, right. and they said, you can come along. Well, you know, I took my little cassette machine. We went to Liberty Island. And they actually had planned this whole operation. This was in 1971. We went up with the last group of tourists, and we slowly sort of dropped back from them. So they went up to the top of the Statue of Liberty, and they had wire cutters with them, and they took the wire cutters and opened up the arm of the Statue of Liberty. And we went in there, and we're hanging in the arm of the Statue of Liberty. And I'm recording all this on my cassette machine, and all of a sudden, like a nickel or something fell out of my pocket, and you could hear it bouncing all the way down. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, tomorrow morning's headline in the Times is going to be, four Vietnam veterans and one unidentified male found in the arm of the Statue of Liberty, you know, in the ocean. But we actually did it and brought back the story, and actually the headline of the Times the next day was Statue of Liberty taken over by Vietnam veterans.
Amazing.
I just wanted to add one thing, which is...
This is Margo Adler.
Yeah, Margo Adler here. I just think it's really important for people to realize that at the height of the Vietnam War, after the 11 o'clock news, there was the war summary.
Yes.
And Paul did a lot of that war summary. And the war summary had 500,000 people listening every day.
If I'd known that, I'd never would have gotten.
Yeah, but I mean, the fact is that it was incredibly popular. Yes. It had an incredible effect on people's perception of the war and using AFP and so forth. And I know, you know, I'm being the serious person here, but it really was important. It really had an incredible importance to this station.
You know,
to be remembered.
I can state through secondhand knowledge.
This is Jim Freund.
That. The Central Intelligence Agency listened to the GOR score, the war summary, because it was the only place that was reporting from AFP and Agence France-Presse. So it was a unique source of intelligence and information.
Well, that explains why all of a sudden my draft status went from 4F to 1A. Please let me, I want to make it clear that I didn't start the war summary. Mm-hmm. It was Paul Schaefer who started the war summary, a brilliant innovation. And I started to say there were two things I did. One was to get people out there with those cassette machines because the technology existed and we could actually take people outside the studio. We could take you there.
Right.
The second innovation was to make the news open-ended. It wasn't a 15-minute newscast. It wasn't a half-hour newscast. The news took as long as it took. And we built buffers around miscellany periods so that the news always started at 6:30 and always ended when it ended. I wasn't trying to pad stories out, and I wasn't trying to squeeze stories down.
Among the many archives that have been forthcoming lately, in the last several days, is a program called Summer Day. I don't know if that was a series. It appeared to have taken place on the steps of the church.
Yes, I do remember that.
I mean, the story about an oil spill in Coney Island that went on for days and followed then by an exhaustive coverage of the day's events in Vietnam. It makes you gasp to think that that kind of coverage was, that we were capable of that, that and that you were all so very young. That really, did, what part did your youth play in this? I mean, it was a very funny place, but this was very serious stuff.
For one thing, being the same age as the people in the counterculture gave us access that the networks didn't have, right. Even if they were interested. And that's very different from actually advocacy journalism, because I don't think there is such a thing as advocacy journalism. You're either an advocate or you're a journalist. Mm-hmm. What I mean is that we were. yes, that's
just
yes.
Wanting to clarify that.
And that was a very important part of the news that of the newscast at WBAI at that time. We covered the movement. We weren't the movement. And I remember one time during the McCarthy, this would be Gene McCarthy, Gene McCarthy Robert Kennedy race. Something bad was going on in Albany where Robert Kennedy was doing something cutthroat to the McCarthy camp. And I found out about it, and I said, well, I'm going to report it on the, on our next newscast. And somebody said to me, you can't do that. I said, well, why not? And this person said, because it's bad for the movement. And, I'm sorry, but, my job is to report the news. It's your job to decide whether it's good for the movement or not. That's what the audience is there for. What is it? We report, you decide. I mean, it's really funny that's now the Fox News motto. But it's just a motto. I mean, I just happen to believe that we report, you decide actually is the way it ought to be. Also, no bias, no bull. As soon as they start doing these slogans at you, you know they mean exactly the opposite of what they say. I have found bias and I have found bull, and they don't report, and I don't decide. So,
and that's why you do musicals.
and that's why I do musicals.
Let's take another little break so that we can get some of our other guests near a microphone here. This is the opening salvo of WBAI's 50th birthday, birthday and anniversary of its marriage to Pacifica. We should say that the Pacifica Foundation took over WBAI on this day 50 years ago.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City
on the FM band. The station that brings you culture, music, phonograph cartridges dragged across the floor.
Yeah, I don't think
endless lectures on sheep raising in southern Iceland.
WBAI in New York City.
In just a little while, perhaps around 4:30, we'll be here with a live jazz program. If you're listening and if you can hang on, stay tuned for that. In the meantime, we turn you back to Steve Post.
And this is Steve Post, WBAI's guest announcer. And full-time bookkeeper.
The thing that seems to me most important at this moment is help from the people who do listen to the station at present.
You're listening to WBAI in New York. The program is Cousin Cuisine, and I'm Bernard Leroy.
WBAI.
Turn your radio down.
Turn your radio down.
He'll get that in a minute.
WBAI.
Tell me, what is your favorite gripe about the station?
Well, I have one that comes up from time to time, and that is simply that I wake up by a clock radio. And sometimes when I have it continually tuned into BAI, the guy that has that early show doesn't arrive until late. And the first thing I hear is when I'm rushing to get out.
I'm going to have to get my beard trimmed or thinned out because when I drink coffee or any coffee, I'm already sounding like a bloody New Yorker. Coffee, give me a cup of coffee. Wow, I'm losing my California accent. Whenever I drink coffee, which isn't too often because he is the production director, a lot of coffee gets caught in my mustache. My mustache acts as a sponge, and then I have to sort of suck the excess coffee out of my mustache. So I have to do something about that. I wonder, maybe I could have some irrigation tubes surgically implanted in my upper lip. Yeah, I'm sure there's a doctor, a surgeon somewhere who would do that for an appropriate fee.
Now, subscriber, we've got to punch you up. So, please stand by.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.